Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Baudrin. With me is my co-host, Mr. Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing today, my man?
I'm doing great. It's my favorite day of the week, the day that we get to record Breaking Kayfabe with Baudrin and Barry.
Absolutely. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture, fast food, restaurants. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to be discussing two of my matches that should have been in the top 100, according to various people. We are going to take a look at some underrated gimmicks from the 80s that time may have forgotten. And we are going to take a look at our top five creepy movies. Now, let me just paraphrase here, Barry, so that people understand. We're not talking about freaking horror here. We're talking creepiness. So, that being said, Barry, you about ready to go on today's show?
I am ready to rock and roll. I've got a cup of coffee next to me. Ozzy the Wonder Dog is to my left. And I'm real excited about today's show. We had such an amazing response to the fast food episode that we did last week that, knowing what our topic is this week, which are creepy movies and creepy scenes for movies as well, I think this is just going to be fantastic this week.
Yeah, and, it's funny you brought up Ozzy, who we discuss every week. So let me tell you what an enabler my wife and I are. My boy Gunny, I may have mentioned in a prior episode, about 2 months ago or so, was diagnosed with a torn ACL. Who knows dogs gonna have an ACL? So Gunny was doing some limping. He's kind of made a recovery, doing a little better now. My wife and I actually went out and we bought an ottoman. We bought an ottoman so that Gunny would have easier access to jump into the bed. It's like I was sitting there thinking, how ridiculous is this? We're trying to help this dog get into our damn bed. So
absolutely.
So shout out to my boy Gunny. And I, by God, he better use the ottoman. Otherwise, we wasted that money for nothing. So, Barry, why don't we go right away to our man, John McAdam, who is a prior guest on Breaking Kayfabe. Back when it was Breaking Kayfabe with Jeff Baudrin, not Breaking Kayfabe with Baudrin and Barry. Not that I want to mention those past times, but John was a previous guest, I believe, on episode 2. So right now we're going to go to my man, John McAdam, and we're going to discuss one of the matches that he feels should have been in my top 100 of the 80s. Let's go and visit with Johnny Mac. Okay, we are joined by friend of the show. I'd like to consider him a friend. John McAdam has joined Barry and I. Johnny Mac, how you doing, buddy?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you for having me on. How are you?
I'm doing well. And today we have had John join us because John, the way Barry, I consider Barry my resident CWF expert, along with guys like Howard Baum, Pete Lederberg, that sort of thing. Johnny Mac is my go-to guy for WWF history, especially we're talking late 70s, early 80s. That's when I think, John, if I'm correct, isn't that when you pretty much first became a big fan?
Yeah, I first became a big fan like summer of 76, and Bob Backlund showed up Christmas Day on TV in 76. So I was a big fan throughout his entire WWF run.
Well, that's good because we are going to talk specifically. I talked about how people had sent me matches that should have been in my top 100, but maybe they weren't in there. And so John texted me and said, here's a couple matches that I want you to talk about that I feel should have been. So John and Barry, we're going to first start discussing 1982, Bob Backlund versus Adrian Adonis. So before I go to you, John, Barry, you've had a chance to watch this match. Tell me what you thought about it.
And looking at this match too, Adonis was so comfortable as a wrestler. And what I mean by that is if you watch him even prior to the match, the guy belongs in the ring. It's not that he was a fantastic wrestler, though he was, or he was a really good interview, though he was. He kind of has this sense when he's in the ring, he truly belongs. So I'll give you my notes on this match. It was a solid match. The first half is a little plodding to me. It's a little slower than I would like for a main event at the world's most famous arena. Backlund is working over Adonis's left arm for primarily most of that first 15 minutes. And then Adonis really starts to crank it up towards the second half. He's a fantastic bump taker for a guy his size as well. Just he's right up there with maybe Kurt Hennig and some of the other great bump takers of our generation. But he nails Backlund with this left hand, and it's so great to hear Vince. Vince says, Adonis with the left hand, that really smoked him. And then about 30 seconds later, Adonis gives this fantastic standing drop kick on Backlund that I don't think I had ever seen Adonis do before. And I mean, it's literally just one of those amazing drop kicks, kind of like that Chiruta drop kick that we discussed a few weeks back. Adonis also does this really great power slam. It's a standing power slam, nobody coming off the ropes or anything like that at the 23-minute mark. And it's just a thing of beauty. We talked about this last week when we talked about the Ken Patera match versus Backlund, the Texas Death Match that took place. And I mentioned Backlund's pile driver. Well, he does it again in this match. And Amal Pitts, you gave it a shout out this past week, so I'm giving you a shout out. Just to Backlund, for whatever faults Backlund may have had, and I realize, you know, I've always been a Backlund fan. At the same time, his pile driver is literally as good as anybody's in professional wrestling. Backlund bleeds. The match is stopped on blood. I thought it was a good match. I don't see it as a top 100 match, and I kind of put that, I think it's the first half of the match. It's a slow build-up, and while I get, you know, a slow build-up can be a great thing, there's something that's missing from the first half of the match, and I'm not quite sure what it is. Adonis is on the top of his game. Backlund is actually having a strong match. I'm not quite sure, and I think even the fans in the first half of the match, they aren't going insane. And we're going to talk about a match later on today where the fans are going insane, and it really does add something to it. But I was a huge Adrian Adonis fan, and Jeff, you and I have talked about it. You know, and John, are you a huge Adrian Adonis fan or even a fan at all?
Very, very much a big fan of Adrian Adonis before the 1986 version.
Yeah, which really is it's a travesty when they made him a transvestite. It just, you know, a completely different guy. But we saw Adrian twice in Florida. He came in 74 underneath his real name of Keith Frankie. And I was here for maybe 2 or 3 months max, strictly prelims. I don't remember a whole lot about him, but he came back in 77 and stayed for about half a year, and he literally was as good as anybody on the card at that stage. He still was in decent shape, still going underneath Keith Frankie, Keith Frank, Keith Franks. They never seemed that they could ever get the name right on a weekly basis. But the guy was such a major league talent. And I think this match is kind of a showcase, at least the second half, of what he was capable of. So, again, I think my end result, I like the match. I don't know if it's a top 100 for me.
Okay, John, now tell us why you think this match belongs on my top 100 list.
I thought it was an excellent match. I'll tell you what, I watched that match again last night, right before, you know, we had this conversation, and this was one of Backlund's very best title matches, available on video, and it just underlines Ric Flair blew Bob Backlund away as a worker. I mean, this was Backlund at his very best, and it was really good, but Flair was way better. But anyway, segues aside, I just thought that there were matches on your top 100 that I thought the Backlund Adonis match was better than. However, after seeing it again last night, I don't think it was an egregious mistake leaving it off. Like, I could see, okay, you know, this match was probably right around 50-60, but it definitely wasn't top 10.
Okay, so let me ask both you guys now, and I believe, John, you've also had an opportunity. Tell me which one you think was better, Backlund Adonis or Backlund Ken Patera that Barry and I discussed last show? Barry?
After what?
Sorry, John. That's okay. So I think – so I'm gonna put an asterisk on it, but I think the Backlund Patera match was better as a match as a whole. As a performer, I actually think Adonis was even better than Patera.
John?
I agree that Adrian Adonis might have been the best in-ring performer in the world in 1982 and 1983, and that includes everybody. That's how good he was, not just in the WWF, but in Southwest, the AWA, etc. I actually thought the Patera match was better. I say that because it was a Texas Death Match, and a lot of the time when they had a Texas Death Match in the WWF, it looked like a regular match. You know, these guys weren't throwing the rules out the window. They weren't trying to kill each other. If you look at the Bob Backlund versus Bobby Duncan match from 6 months earlier, it was like a regular match. This match, they looked like they were like out for blood. It was a grudge match. They were looking to kill each other. There was double juice. And you know, they were just doing things that they wouldn't normally do in a match. They were brawling outside the ring. They were slamming each other into tables, stuff like that.
Yeah. So here's my thoughts on the match. Besides feeling that this would have been just outside, I think this is a really good match. As Barry pointed out, I don't know that it was a top 100 also. But here's a couple of notes that I made. Number one, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed Vince McMahon's call of this match. I thought he was really strong. A couple things that I never thought I would have, you know, hear coming out of Vince McMahon's mouth was when Backlund entered the ring, he mentioned that Backlund was a former NCAA champion. And I'm like, who knew Vince knew about that stuff? And then he mentions, and this really cracked me up, because at the time, Adrian Adonis was doing the leather jacket, leather hat, gloves bit. I don't know whether or not he got this from the Al Pacino film Cruising, but it was, I mean, it was straight out of that movie, his getup. And Vince kept making a point of how much Adrian loved leather. And I thought that was really funny. But during a breakup, and Vince is like, come on, ref, you should be breaking that up. And, you know, I believe Adonis threw a punch, and Vince was reprimanding the referee, saying that it's supposed to be an open hand. It's not supposed to be a closed fist. And so that was the thing I really noticed about this match, was how much I enjoyed Vince's call of the match. Now, Adonis, as was stated, took some just terrific bumps. He has this patented bump that he would do, and I've seen him do it in other matches, where he's on the top rope, he gets his legs knocked from under him, and he does the patented crotch spot on the ropes. And as good as he was doing it in this particular match, I thought the crotch spot looked really kind of hokey, and it looked like he was basically doing a movie stunt. There was another spot where he gets thrown into the ropes, and he goes to do not the Ray Stevens flip that, you know, Flair mastered, but instead he's doing it where he flips and goes whole body into the corner. The second one he did looked okay, but the first time he did the spot, it looked really planned out. And again, it looked like something you would see in a Hollywood movie. So that kind of disappointed me. I do agree with John. Adrian Adonis was an amazing performer at this point in his career. He had a really kind of, I don't know how I can say it, like a weird shape for a pro wrestler. He wasn't fat at this point, but he wasn't solid like a musclehead guy either. But he had tremendous stamina, threw a great looking punch. I actually, one of our Facebook posters, Kevin Orcott, had sent me some links to some Portland stuff, and I was looking it up, and you know, lo and behold, there's Adrian Adonis, and this must have been around 1980, 81. There's Adrian Adonis out in Portland feuding with Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper, and he threw the same standing dropkick in that match that he throws in this match that Barry mentioned. So, yeah, I really like this match. Now, that being said, I'm not sure that the Patera match wasn't better in my eyes, because Patera was so the key to Bob Backlund having a great match, obviously, was to put him with the right opponent. And, you know, Adonis and Patera, I don't know if they were to the level of Morocco. John, what do you think about that? Do you think Morocco was Backlund's best opponent?
No, actually, I think Backlund's best opponent, let me see, based on what's available on video, I would say Ken Patera. The series he had against Patera in 1980 was incredible. The best, I've said this before, the best Backlund match I've ever seen was against Bob Orton Jr. at the Boston Garden, where no footage is available, but it was an incredible match.
Yeah, that, and I know in his book, the Bob Backlund biography that he wrote, he mentions that his favorite opponent was Pat Patterson, because they did the series of four matches in the Garden as opposed to three. I don't know. Is the Patterson stuff out there? I don't even know. Do you know, John?
Yes, there's a match from the Spectrum, and there's, I think, a couple of matches from Madison Square Garden, including the cage match. One thing that might make the Patera match better, too, when Adrian Adonis came to the WWF to wrestle Backlund, we all know he wasn't winning the title. There was no way. Patera, when he came back, you could see it. You know, you could see him getting that superstar Billy Graham run. He had already established himself as a major star in, like, you know, 76 through 78. He came right back in fall of 79, winter 79, and he looked good. And he looked the part. So there was a chance, you would think, that he was going to win the title, even though he didn't.
So both these matches, really, really good matches, solid matches. I'm not sure that they're top 100 of the 80s, but obviously, if they're not in there, they're close. I would say, you know, like John said, maybe they're certainly not top 20, but the key to a good Bob Backlund match is, again, is Bob having a great opponent. And in this case, with both guys, I think that's definitely the case. I also agree with what John just said. Adrian Adonis did not strike you as the kind of guy that was going to go home with the belt. Ken Patera, Don Morocco, those kind of guys, I don't think you really knew what going into the match whether or not there was going to be a title change. So that's a pretty valid point. Barry, anything more to say on this this match?
No, and that maybe sums up why the first half of the match was a little bit lackluster for me, was because I never bought Adonis. Though he's an incredible performer, I never bought him as a guy who was going to win the title. So it seemed like, yeah, okay, what's really the point then? To that end, I will say I think my favorite Adrian Adonis was probably the tag team with Dick Murdoch. I just, watching those vignettes when they were driving around Harlem and, you know, they were looking for Adrian's uncle just was such fun stuff. And as a team, those guys were just great together.
Yeah, and I believe Adrian, by the way, still has the all-time record for touching sewer cap covers, Do you remember that gimmick?
Exactly.
Very fun.
So the best thing about the Morocco, the Murdoch and Adonis team, where they cheated so well. They were so good at cheating.
So yeah, and you know, so many people remember Adonis from his team with Ventura in the AWA, and that was a great team too. You had one guy that was the talker and one guy that was the worker. And in the case of Adonis and Murdoch, both guys could go and both guys could really talk by that point. So, you know, it was Barry's absolutely right. That was a fantastic team. So John, we really appreciate you stopping in, buddy, and offering you. By the way, this is your second appearance on the show. So besides Barry, you're the only multi-appearance guest. So,
well, and I hope to be on a third time soon.
Well, don't get your hopes up, because you know we got to review. We got to review how your appearance went, Mr. Big Shot. So, anyway, John, why don't you real quick remind the fans where they can find you on Facebook? Because I know you got your own Facebook page that a lot of people enjoy going to, myself included.
Yeah, it's called Pro Wrestling and Whatever, and that's pretty much what it is. Pro Wrestling and Whatever. There's a lot of NCAA basketball talk going on right now, so
I can only imagine. So, along with Barry Rose, I would say thank you so much for your appearance, John, and we will talk to you later, my man.
Thanks for having me on. Go Vols.
Okay, Barry, how about John McAdam, huh?
That was awesome, man. You know, it's such a great idea, too, to get somebody who was in the territory, that was there, that saw these matches, and they're kind of experts. And you mentioned me for Florida, and certainly you've got guys, you know, Scott Bowden down in Memphis. There's guys in Texas. I think it's a great idea. So having John Mack on today was a stroke of genius, Jeffrey Wayne Baldwin.
Well, I'm just going to rub my chin a little bit and agree with you on that. I am nothing if not a genius when it comes to being a broadcaster, by God, podcaster. Anyway, before we get going on our next match, a couple of quick shout-outs. Barry, do you know who I saw back on the Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry Facebook page? Do you know who I saw that I hadn't seen in a couple weeks? Travis Reigns. Where's he been? I haven't seen him in forever. So, hey, Travis, just welcome back to the page, my man.
It's always good to see Travis. We'll be seeing Travis apparently on June the 2nd in Tampa at the CWF Legends Fan Fest 3. We're organizing a dinner, but I know that we are now making a special trip to the Chicago-based Portillo's restaurant that is in Tampa currently. And I know I'm pretty excited. We talked about it last week. I'm going on a diet, Jeff. I have decided for the next 2 months, I am going to eat a little bit healthier. I'm going to eat a little bit less. And then when I get to Tampa, I'm going to eat enough for 10 individuals.
Well, as a matter of fact, my wife and I went out to a Chicago place here in the Fort Lauderdale area called Chi-Town. And I had the Italian beef wet, of course, and it was freaking amazing. Any of you listeners out there in the Broward County or South Florida region, I'm talking Chi-Town on McNabb Road here in the area. You got to go for a good Italian beef, good sausage, good pizza. Great, great restaurant, and I really enjoyed it. Now, let's go to our second match, Barry. Enough of that. We are talking 1986, the spring of 86. We're talking Ricky Morton versus Ric Flair. Now, here's the funny part. We're not exactly sure what the venue was, folks. This is a match that's on YouTube. It's about a 32-minute match. With just some crazy, crazy heat from the crowd. I reached out to my friend John Hitchcock, prior guest on the show. I reached out to Bruce Mitchell. I'm saying, guys, you're the Mid-Atlantic guys. Where was this at? And, of course, naturally, they both came up with a different answer. So, that being said, Barry, tell us what you thought of this match.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So, unlike the other match, this is a top 100 match by far. So, and we should quantify this, too. The reason that we can't put any sort of identification on the venue or even a date or anything like that, this was shot by a fan. This is handheld footage by one of the old video camcorders. It's a great match, but really, what did you expect from these two? Of course it's going to be a great match. You know, this is my takeaway from this. We can go through and we can talk about this. This is a 30-minute match between two of the best workers of that decade, of at least the mid-1980s, between Flair and Morton. So, look, is it a five-star match? I think it is. I don't know if stars, if that works or that doesn't work, but this is as good as any match on U.S. soil that you're going to see in the 1980s. For me, there was a couple of takeaways of this one. The one first thing that I got was, when you're going to compare house shows of the NWA versus the WWF, there is no comparison. Again, this was not being filmed to air on television. These two guys went out, they worked a five-star match only in front of fans, with this match never making any sort of television, the internet, anything like that. That's how good it was. I went to a whole bunch of WWF shows in the 1980s, and I can tell you, if they weren't being filmed, they stunk. The ones that were being filmed usually stunk. So just to give you an idea. So that really says a lot to me, but this is my big takeaway on this one. Ricky Morton, and this is as good of a match that Ricky Morton's ever had. Would you agree with that? Or do you want to wait and give me your thoughts? But as I'm watching this, I'm blown away. And I've always thought Morton was good, but this is at a different level of greatness. He is a credible singles challenger to Ric Flair in this match. This is not a guy that is one half of a tag team. That's not what I saw. I saw a guy that could hold his own with Ric Flair. I really, truly thought this was such an amazing match. But here was my takeaway. Could Morton have gotten a huge singles push and maybe been the NWA version of Shawn Michaels, obviously granted 5 or 6 years earlier? He was a better worker. He was much less of a douchebag than Shawn Michaels was, and he was more over with the fans. What are your thoughts on that one?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, one of the things is I'm watching this match that, you know, it's funny, when we were talking to John about Adrian Adonis and how Adrian Adonis may not have been perceived as the guy that could have possibly taken Bob Backlund's belt. As I'm watching this match, and you're absolutely right, this is it's an incredible match. Both guys just at their absolute zenith of their careers. I never felt like Ricky Morton was going to be a guy that was going to take the world strap. And, you know, one of the biggest problems I had with Flair at this point in time, this might have been the peak of Flair. And you know, that's really, to me, saying a lot, because Ric Flair had such a long run on top of the business. But this took place somewhere in the spring, maybe early summer of 1986. This was right after they had done the angle where Ric Flair had been teasing Ricky Morton about the fact that most of his fans were teeny boppers. He did the big angle where they brought out the little training bra, and he said, "This is the kind of stuff that your fans are into." And then Ricky famously takes off Flair's sunglasses in the TBS studios, breaks the sunglasses. They go into the ring, and there's a big brawl. One of the great stories that I don't really know how many people know about is that during the brawl in TBS, Flair had not taken his Rolex off. And as they're battling back and forth, apparently Ric Flair broke his Rolex, and he was not real happy about that. But, this is a fantastic match. I really wish I knew if it was in Raleigh or Charlotte or where, because the crowd is absolutely electric. But again, as I'm watching this match, and they did a great job of making it seem as though Ricky Morton had a chance, because let me tell you something. The fans are completely going out of their minds with the possibility that Ric Flair is going to lose to stinking Ricky Morton, Punky Morton, and they're on the edge of their seats, popping for every move. But as I watched this match, I went, you know, is Ricky Morton really a guy that was going to beat Ric Flair for the world title? And part of the problem that I felt was, if you look back and you think about this time, this is, of course, when Flair was becoming more and more just a Crockett guy. He wasn't going out to the territories as much anymore. And I really wondered if Ric Flair, as great as he was at this point in his career, think about it, if his best challenger was Ricky Morton, were there no other guys out there at this point? You know, Magnum was doing the Nikita thing, but Magnum against Ric Flair would have been a believable challenge to me. But I really, as I started watching this match, you know, and I'm highly entertained by this match, I'm going, wow, it's a great match. Flair is bumping like a champ. But did I really think that Ricky Morton was going to win the belt? No. And part of the problem that I had with that as I was watching it, as I was thinking back at the time, Hulk Hogan is really getting over as the WWF champion. He's getting over as the guy that is perceived by the casual fan as the world champion. And why is that? Well, because the casual fan, Hulk Hogan's winning his matches in 5 minutes. He's doing the leg drop against guys like Bundy, John Studd, all those other guys, Andre the Giant. Maybe that feud hadn't started just yet. But Ric Flair is going 30 minutes with a guy that weighs 35 pounds less than him. you know, a little teeny bopper guy. And that has to be the perception of the casual fan. You and I are watching this match, and guys in Mid-Atlantic like Hitchcock and Mitchell, they're watching this match and going, holy crap, this is a great match. But really, if you're a casual fan watching this match, you're sitting there thinking, why is the world champion getting his ass kicked by this little guy? Am I completely off base there?
Well, no, and I see what you're saying, but I think we also have the luxury of viewing that in hindsight and coming up with
that. Oh, absolutely. Opinion. You're absolutely right about that, yes.
Yeah, but I do think here's the takeaway, too. If you watch this match and you look at the fans, it looks to me like every one of these fans believed that Morton had a shot that night. Like, it's they're
no,
up,
there's
they're
no question
screaming.
About it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the difference of the last match that we just talked about, is that, you know, the fans are much more subdued. I don't think anybody truly thought that Adonis had a prayer of walking away with the title. But in this arena tonight, you know, and again, I don't know if this is Greensboro or it's a Raleigh or Charlotte, there's people jumping up and down, and you can watch people walking by ringside, I guess, as they're trying to get to their seat, and they're walking really slowly. And I remember that from the old days when fans had to get by you to get to their seat. They didn't rush to get to their seat. They would slowly, with this real slow pace, watch, and they never took their face, their eyes off of the ring. So I was blown away by this match. I didn't expect that, because initially when you sent me the link and you said, this is one of the matches we should talk about, I looked at it and I said, 30 minutes? You know, I'm a big proponent of 10-minute matches. And I got to be honest, 20 minutes into this match, I was kind of praying it was going to go an hour. This was very similar. I had a very similar reaction to the Kurt Hennig-Nick Bockwinkel match that we reviewed a few months back. There's a lot of similarities between these two matches to me.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And, you know, as a matter of fact, because there are definite points during the match when you can see that there's been some editing done, I wonder, this may have been a 60-minute match that only has 30 minutes available online. So I'm not even completely sure about that. Yeah, you know, a couple other things. They do a really unique spot in this match that I really like, where Morton takes Flair's arm, puts it over the top rope, Flair's in the corner, and he wraps his arm around the rope. And then he kicks the rope, so the rope snaps back on Flair's arm. And I'd never seen that spot before. And he does it a couple times, and I'm watching that going, you know, that's a really unique spot that I don't recall seeing. And, you know, you've seen the stuff where they kick the guy's arm and they work it over like, you know, the Andersons used to do. But to me, that made it a really interesting point in the match, because, you know, at this point, after all the years that I've been watching wrestling, to see a spot that I don't ever recall seeing, I thought that was a really fun spot. One thing that is a spot that seems like it happens in every Flair match, especially in every Flair match at this time period, is what I'll call the Ric Flair ass shot. He's trying to get out of the ring. Morton grabs his tights, pulls his tights down. Flair walks around bare ass for the fans. I don't know if that's like just something Ric Flair enjoyed doing, or if it was like a joke or what. What I really got a kick out of, as he's walking around, Tommy Young reaches down and grabs Ric Flair's trunks and pulls his ass, and then starts kind of chewing him out for having his ass out. Do you remember that spot?
I do, yeah. It was kind of funny, too. And we got to say, so I mentioned Tommy also, but you and I have talked about Tommy Young's importance to Ric Flair's career, and certainly to, say, the Flair Steamboat series. But even in this match, and again, you make a great point. This is probably a 60-minute match or something close to it, because there are a lot of edits, and this is over 30 minutes that we actually have. Tommy Young is as good in that first minute as he is at the very end of the match. Like, Tommy Young goes, he literally goes 100 miles an hour as well, keeping up with these guys. And we should also say, this match is not a match where they're sitting on into rest holds either. This is a match that literally is going and going and going. I was completely blown away, and I absolutely love this match. So here's the deal. How could you have included this match if you didn't know it actually existed?
Well, there is that. So
right. I mean, it would be impossible.
I will say this, for anybody out there listening to this podcast who does not believe that Ricky Morton was a guy that was one of the three best baby faces I've ever seen at selling, watch this match and watch how, when Ricky Morton gets into the ring at the very beginning of the match, I mean to tell you, the fans are going absolutely apeshit. They love this guy. And full credit to Ricky Morton for getting himself over, and for, you know, a guy that I like to occasionally give a lot of crap to. Dusty Rhodes had done a great job as booker of putting Ricky Morton in this position to where he was that over with the crowd. I mean, it's partly the booker's responsibility. It's partly the fault. You know, Ricky Morton had a lot to do with it also. But man alive, was Ricky Morton won over SOB at this point in his career. It was absolutely amazing to see the way that the crowd reacted to him.
Yeah, well, look, you're 100% right with that. This guy was as over as anybody. And if you're not a Ricky Morton fan, watch this match because you will be. I will say, I think another huge plus of this match is not, and I don't mean to pick on it, but is not having David Crockett doing the commentary and the announcing. So you talked about Vince McMahon and how he really added to the other match, and he did. If we would have had to have listened to David Crockett for 30 minutes to discuss this match, I think it would have brought it down a notch.
Get him, Tony. Look at him, Tony. Look at him, Tony.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably do without that. So, all right, now we're going to take a look at a couple of gimmicks that I think time may have forgotten that I felt were really strong that maybe not enough people remember. So we're going to try to jog some memory. The first one we're going to talk about is we're going, I believe it was 1988, 1989 in that time frame, to Continental, which was a promotion in Alabama. And that is the famous angle. Talk about it, Barry. Talk about an angle that could not go over today. This would not. You will never see this angle in a television show now. And that is a famous angle involving Tom Pritchard and the Dirty White Girl. Barry, you had a chance to watch this angle recently. Tell me what you thought of it.
Yeah, so I can't stand it. And I don't know if I'm viewing it with the sensibility of 2017, but I have to tell you, the first time I saw it, I was really disturbed. It comes off, and in a nutshell, it's Dirty White Boy who is working an angle with his wife where he's abusing her, and she's got the black eye, she's beaten up, and it's all basically to sucker in Tom Pritchard and turn on him. At the same time, this is, you know, wrestling for so many years has been associated with the lowest common denominator. And as a wrestling fan, I can't imagine I can't even recall the amount of times that I've had to defend professional wrestling. I don't do it anymore. I just basically say, fuck you, and walk away. But in my younger days, I would have had to have defended it. And this is, you know, there were certain gimmicks. We talked about the Adrian Adonis transvestite gimmick, which really was super embarrassing to a wrestling fan because, you know, non-wrestling fans have no idea what it is. And this is also one of those. So luckily, I never had to defend or describe what was taking place here. At the same time, this is, in my opinion, lowest common denominator stuff. I'm just not a fan of it, that, you know, you want to work an angle around a guy who's physically beating up his wife. Not a fan, man. Not a fan.
No. I trust me, I completely get that. This was a really I believe this won the 88 Wrestling Observer angle or, like, you know, gimmick of the year. What was really troubling about this, you know, first of all, that she comes out, she's got the black eye, and she's like, I just want to talk to Tom, please. Can I talk to Tom, please? And Gordon Solie is the announcer, I believe with Charlie Platt. And he says, my God, child, what happened to your eye? And he's, you know, obviously he realizes what's being inferred there. And so he has Charlie go out and get Tom Pritchard. Tom Pritchard wants nothing to do with this because this is in the middle of a Tom Pritchard Dirty White Boy feud that's been going on. So Tom Pritchard comes out. You know, one thing, let me ask you, you know what always struck me about Tom Pritchard? Tom Pritchard always seemed to me like a guy that was doing kind of a bad Roddy Piper impersonation. What do you think?
Yep. Yeah. No, absolutely. So Tom Pritchard was a good worker, but he was doing a Piper impersonation. You can say it, whatever it is, he absolutely was doing a Piper impersonation.
So, yeah. So then, obviously, they end up, the Dirty White Girl maneuvers him to where his back is to where Dirty White Boy comes in. He hits him with a chair shot or something. And then they end up, to make it even kind of more ridiculous, they put a noose around Tom Pritchard's neck, and they drag Tom Pritchard all the way up to the ring, and they do the bit where they hang him. Dirty White Boy's hanging him. Dirty White Girl is clapping. She's so happy this is happening. And, you know, the definition of a great angle, folks, is a great angle that's well done. Plus, it makes money. And I'm not sure this promotion really made tons of cash off of this for being as controversial. And again, you know, this angle is out there on YouTube. You can certainly access and watch it. But as much as the whole, you know, battered wife thing was disturbing, the hanging part of it too, because this wasn't like he starts hanging him for 2 or 3 seconds and then the you know, the guys come in from the back and save time. I mean, he was hanging him for a while there. Am I wrong, Barry?
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
And you know, if you weren't troubled enough by the whole battered spouse thing, the hanging on television, they did that on CWF with Blackjack and Kevin Sullivan, right?
Yeah, they did. It was done. I think it was done a little bit. Like, it was done a little bit differently, and certainly ECW did a lot of stuff that was controversial with, you know, the Sandman on the cross with the Raven angle and stuff like that. I just, you know, it all goes back to the fact that, you know, if professional wrestling, it was so hard as a kid. I remember when we were doing, and I don't know if I even told you the story, but Jeff and I were doing a newsletter 25, 30 years ago, and it was called Share Shots, and it was a cheap little rag, you know, as Mark Madden once called it. And I was at the post office, and I was mailing issues of Chair Shots, and the person behind me goes, "What is that?" And I didn't know this person at all. And it was an older lady at the time. And I said, "Oh, it's a newsletter devoted to professional wrestling." And I had to, for the next 5 minutes, sit there and listen to her. Like I gave a shit. Had to listen to her thoughts on professional wrestling and basically how it was just, you know, phony, fake, and degrading, etc. It's angles like this that give those morons kind of fuel.
So now let's talk about an angle that I really liked. And I think, Barry, you had a chance to look at it, and you were like, that is the angle with Jason the Terrible and the Zodiac in Calgary. We're talking around 1986. This was right after Owen Hart had debuted, maybe 86, 87. Barry, you had a chance to look at a couple things with the Zodiac and Jason the Terrible. Tell me what you thought.
Yeah, well, I'm going to curse you, Jeffrey Wayne Baldwin, because what? I stayed up last night. I'm going to curse you. I stayed up an additional 90 minutes on YouTube. I started watching Jason and the Zodiac, and literally within 2 minutes, I wasn't even blinking any longer because I was hooked. This is, I should have said, at the time when I saw this, and I think I saw this within a year or two of it taking place in the early 90s when somebody sent me a DVD, and I think I dismissed it. And I think partly is, it's got this kind of slightly cheesy or very cheesy kind of 1980s horror movie vibe mixed in with a 1980s video game, the way these promos are being cut. And I sat there last night and I was going, this is the greatest thing I have ever seen. I watched every video that is on YouTube, and there's a bunch of them, because whoever put these out there was just putting on, in every YouTube video, there's 5 or 6 interviews. So I watched every single one, then I watched their matches. Eventually, I guess they split up and they wrestle each other. I was as taken with this as anything I've ever seen. It could never play the same way today, but if you get a chance to go and see this, this is revolutionary, I think. I think this gimmick, honestly, is kind of revolutionary. I don't think I've ever seen anything ever like it before. Completely original. And how many times in wrestling do you say, well, this is an original gimmick? You've never said that. It doesn't exist. Everything is being stolen from somebody else. This was about as original as I've ever seen. I loved it. This gets 5 stars from me. I absolutely love this. The only negative is fucking Ed Whalen, after everyone has to come on with his insipid opinions and kind of bury the gimmick, and I hate that. Other than that, this is genius and it's gold.
Yeah, and just credit where it's due, in this gimmick, Jason the Terrible is played by Carl Moffat, who was a wrestler that was up there at the time, and Zodiac is Barry Orton, brother of Bob, and son of Bob Orton Sr., who, by the way, Barry, I know you can tell us, was the Zodiac in Florida, wasn't he?
His father was, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right, yep. Yeah.
And Bob Orton Sr. was the Zodiac, absolutely, yeah.
He was the first one that played the gimmick. Barry played the gimmick here in Calgary and was doing some absolutely amazing interviews. And, you know, it's funny because Barry Orton at the time was a guy that had been seen on WWF TV as kind of a job guy. He was the guy that would give a good match but always lose. But he wasn't the guy that would get destroyed in 20 seconds. He would, you know, get a couple spots in, do some moves. But he would always end up losing. He goes to Calgary under the Zodiac mask and totally reinvented himself. And I'm really sorry that this, you know, gimmick didn't get some play in the other parts of the country. Jason the Terrible, Carl Moffat, continued to work this gimmick as a babyface, believe it or not, which is kind of weird. But Carl Moffat ended up being involved in a car accident up in Calgary. There was a van load of wrestlers. Loaded with wrestlers that went over into a ditch or something and rolled. And Carl Moffat had a really, really serious leg injury that I believe ended up ending his career prematurely, because he was a guy that was a big guy who could take some hellacious bumps, and he was great as a gimmick character performer. And, you know, when I first started seeing this, the first thing I thought to myself, and maybe I'm, you know, overstating how good this angle was, but I could really see some parallels between this and the debut of the Undertaker character with Mark Calloway, because Mark Calloway is a big guy that could take good bumps. And that's kind of what Carl Moffat was. And this was before Mark Calloway became the Undertaker, by the way. So if you watch this gimmick, if you get a chance to look at some of it on YouTube, I want you to watch it and think to yourself how you could see certain parallels. I mean, it's not the same gimmick, obviously, but I'm talking about a big guy under a mask or under a character, you know, that he really found himself. And, you know, I think I agree with Barry. I'm not sure if this is the kind of thing that could have played on a national stage, but in another smaller promotion, I think it definitely could have worked, and it could have worked well because these two are really, really good together. So now, Barry, before we get to our special top five list that we're going to talk about creepy movies, I want to give a couple of shout outs real quick. Chris Spiker asked me when I commented recently, Barry, I don't know if you read, Toys R Us is closing all their stores here in this country. And Toys R Us, of course, is where I got my start. My first real job was as an assistant manager at Toys R Us. And, you know, so he says to me, Jeff, tell me some of your stories from Toys R Us. Give me a top five Toys R Us list. You asked for it, Chris Spiker. You're going to get it. Top five Jeff Bowdren Toys R Us story. Number five, Carolyn Barber. I went on a date with a girl named Carolyn Barber right after my Firebird had gotten stolen. The thieves that stole my car took out my bucket seat, Barry. I had a 67 Firebird that was absolutely in mint condition, and the mother effer stole my bucket seat out of I guess the cops must have come because they found my car with just one bucket seat missing. So I go on a date with Carolyn Barber, Barry. I don't have a front seat. She had to sit in the back seat. She must have thought I was the world's biggest loser, which I probably was. So then number four, we had a guy that was an assistant manager who everyone thought looked kind of like Eddie Munster. So his nickname was fucking Eddie Munster. So one of the other assistant managers one night getting near closing time gets on the PA and says, fucking Eddie Munster, come to aisle three, please. Fucking Eddie Munster. I always thought that was kind of funny. I worked in Hialeah. Hialeah, for those of you who don't know, is Little Havana. That's what they call it. I was working this is number two, a 7 a.m. to 3 a.m. shift at Toys R Us in Hialeah during the Christmas holidays, which was complete insanity, by the way.
Wait, hold on a minute. 7 a.m. to 3 a.m. shift?
Correct. And by the way,
20 hours?
Salaried. No overtime, my man.
Oh, yeah,
that's gotcha. The way they got us. So yep. I had a lady come up to me and say, you're going to work in Hialeah. You better learn to speak the Spanish. She started cursing at me because I told her I didn't speak Spanish.
Sure.
So my number one story about Toys R Us relates to me. My first wife. I met my first wife there. She was a cashier during the Christmas holidays. I began dating my first wife, Barry. I don't even know if I ever told you this story. 5 months pregnant.
Whoa. You're dating, okay, you're dating the cashier who becomes your wife, and she's 5 months pregnant.
Yep.
Okay, you never told me that story. I would have remembered, absolutely.
Yeah, she was five months pregnant. I brought home, and, you know, she wasn't married, obviously. I'm not that kind of lowlife.
Okay.
The guy had done a hit and run. She's 5 months pregnant. I bring her home to meet my parents. That went over well.
That did not go over well.
Yeah, there's some eyebrows being raised on that. So Chris, I hope you appreciated my top five Toys R Us stories. God bless Toys R Us, now going out of business. All right, Barry.
I know we don't have a lot of time, and maybe we'll save this, but I think, well, why don't we do a cliffhanger and pick up this story next week? I kind of want to know what happened with you wound up. Okay, I'll save it for next week. But there's a lot of parts of that story I want to hear more about. But hey, I want to bring something up that I never knew this. And what I like is you and I have been friends for close to 30 years at this point. And a couple of months back, I remember you revealed that you were born in Japan. I never knew that. That was shocking to me. This week, I'm reading something on Facebook. I don't know where. Apparently, you've never eaten a salad in your life.
Never.
And then you drop a bombshell via text to me this morning that you've never had a bagel in your life?
Never.
Seriously?
Seriously.
My wife never had
My wife and I went to Brooklyn Bagel this morning. We'll start talking fast food restaurants again. And my wife ordered the bagel, and I was telling you, yeah, we're at Brooklyn Bagel. Oh, the bagels. I don't know. I don't like them. So never got a taste for a bagel. Never had a salad. When I was a kid, my parents went on vacation, had me stay with their friends across the street. The lady tried to force me to eat a salad. I was 10, 11 years old, and it caused me to gag and almost vomit, and I've never had a salad since then.
Wow.
Yeah, that childhood stuff stays with you, Barry.
It does. It does. I fully agree with that. Wow. So next week, will you be dropping another bombshell on us? Will there be something else, another big reveal, whether it's of the bagel, salad, or Japan variety?
Or maybe more tales of my first wife,
which I do want you to fit. I think everybody listening right now wants to know with the rest of that story. So yes,
I will offer this gem that I remember. So she's getting ready to have the baby, right? She goes in, her mom goes in with her. She has the baby, beautiful little girl. And she comes out on the gurney. I look at her. I'm like, you know, the supportive boyfriend. Oh, honey, you look beautiful. You know, you did such a great job. The baby's beautiful. And the nurse looks at me and smiles. She goes, oh, that's nice. You the husband? I go, no, not the husband. Oh, you're beautiful, honey. Oh, the father? No, not the father. Oh, honey, you're beautiful. The nurse looks at the other nurse and goes, that's the first time I've heard that one. So
that's good.
More that's tales good. Of my first marriage coming next episode here on Breaking Kayfabe.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right, now, folks, it is time to discuss creepy movies. Barry and I, we're going to talk about our top five creepy movies. Again, let me paraphrase, we're not talking pure horror. No one's going to be talking about The Babadook. No one's going to be talking about The Conjuring, Halloween, Friday the 13th. We're talking about movies that had scenes where you watched the scene and you were totally creeped out. I'll give you an example, Barry, because, you know, quite frankly, my list, I had a hard time narrowing it down to five from six. Here's an example of a creepy scene. I'm talking about Requiem for a Dream, which is a movie that came out a few years ago. Very well made, very got some nominations, I think. There's a scene at the end of the movie. The movie is about four drug addicts, a mother, her son, and a couple friends. Barry, you've seen the scene I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
And you see what happens at the very end of their drug addiction. You have one woman getting shock therapy. You have two guys basically tripping out and having all these weird delusions. And then there's the fourth and final character, who's this woman who's basically now having to debase herself to get more drugs. And she goes to a party and let's just say performs an act that is extremely troubling to watch, Barry. Poor Jennifer Connelly, that's all I'm going to say. So that's an example of what I'm talking about, a disturbing or chilling or creepy scene. Barry, tell us your number five movie.
Yeah, so, you know, in realizing, too, that our listening audience is probably 99.2% male, I have two words for my number five movie. It's Vagina Dentata. If you're not familiar, there was a movie that came out about 10 years ago called Teeth, and it was about a young lady who is being sexually molested. She's being raped. She's semi-conscious, and during the rape, her vagina cuts off the man's penis. And apparently, as she goes to a gynecologist, she discovers that she has this condition called vagina dentata, that basically she's got a set of teeth in her vagina, and it can bite off anything that's inserted inside of her. So, of course, the movie is basically about everybody she meets, every guy she meets, just wants to take advantage of her and molest her, and the gynecologist is exactly the same. So he starts to, I guess, give her some sort of checkup, and in the middle of the checkup, he's molesting her. Well, he loses four of his fingers. And it continues. There's more penises being lost. But as a guy, when you see this movie, it's beyond creepy, but it's also extremely frightening, because every time a penis is being cut off, you're just sitting there just going, oh, you know, you start like rubbing your head going, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And these guys are walking around screaming, just covered in blood. And the movie's really riveting. It's very compelling from start to finish. It really is a roller coaster. And even the last scene, and I won't ruin it, to me, it's just such a great last scene. So if you've never seen this movie, it's super creepy. It's super bizarre. We just talked about the Jason and Zodiac gimmick. This is super original. I don't think there's ever been another movie that is based around this myth of vagina dentata. So, Jeff, have you ever seen this?
I have not, and based on what you've told me, I don't think I'm going to be watching it.
And that was my next question.
That sounds extremely troubling. I can just say that.
Oh, it is. It really is, and it's I know when I got it, I'm heavily into horror movies and certainly small movies that don't get a huge release. I really like those. There's nobody really famous in this movie. And I remember when I got it, and I got it on DVD, and I brought it home, and I was like, this is really interesting. And within the first 10 or 15 minutes, I'm like, I don't know if I can watch the rest of this. It really is a little bit troubling. But it does fit the criteria of what our topic is this week. So I leave it at that.
Okay, now my number five movie is a movie from 1976, going back a ways here, Barry, not just all current movies. And this movie from 1976 was made most famous by a single quote from Laurence Olivier to Dustin Hoffman. Is it safe? Is it safe yet? Is it safe yet? Laurence Olivier plays a Nazi doctor who believes that Dustin Hoffman has been given information by his brother, who has been killed. And so Laurence Olivier, and the troubling scene in the movie that, trust me, no one will ever forget. And you will think about it the next time you go to the dentist. He puts him in a chair and he begins probing at his teeth, shall we say, with a dental instrument to get him to talk. And what's so effective about this scene is when he begins to torture Dustin Hoffman, the camera cuts away and all you hear is Dustin Hoffman scream. And I like that so much better than sitting there watching him pull out a tooth. The fact that your brain, I've always said, can imagine things far more horrifying than you'll ever see on a TV screen. Barry, would you agree with that?
Yeah, yes and no. And I got to say, this is a movie. This is the movie. Whenever you talk about this movie, too, and this movie's a fantastic movie. If you've never seen it, this is one of the better movies of the generation. But this is all that anybody ever talks about. Oh my God, the scene in the chair with the, you know, there's no Novocaine, and you know, they're just going on. The acting is so good. Is it better?
Did I even mention the name of the movie is Marathon Man? I'm sitting there thinking.
You did.
Okay.
You said it. It's sometimes your mind is going to, you know, imagine things that are 100 times worse. But, you know, this is a movie, too, that the acting. I mean, you've got Sir Laurence Olivier. I guess he's considered the greatest actor of all time. And you've got Dustin Hoffman, who certainly at that era in the 70s going into maybe the early to mid 80s was really one of the top box office draws. So from an acting standpoint, you had two guys that could really pull this scene off as well.
Yeah, and the scene is just so horrifying. And what's even more horrifying is he sort of almost baits Dustin Hoffman in the beginning, where he's going, oh, you have quite the cavity there. Oh, yeah. And then when he goes back in the second time, he goes, oh, no, I'm not going to. That nerve has already begun to die. I'm going to a fresh live nerve that when I go through the pulp of the tooth, that's where I'll be to the live exposed nerve. Oh, my God. You're sitting there watching this going, oh, my God, he's going to basically kill the guy. And the agony that must occur. I mean, anybody's ever got a cavity filled. When that dentist goes in there, if they haven't put the Novocaine in and they touch the nerve in your tooth and you jump out of the seat, that's what's happening here, folks, except he's not stopping like your dentist, God, I hope so, would stop. That's what makes this scene so terrifying. And this movie has so many gripping scenes like that. Barry, give us number four on your list.
Yeah, so number four, too, is it's a great movie. It's a movie called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. And it's a very small-made movie. Came out in the mid-80s. I want to say it was 1986. It stars Michael Rooker. I think most people know Michael Rooker. He played the brother of Daryl. He was Merle on The Walking Dead for the first couple of years until he became a walker himself. So, and he's done a bunch of movies. He's done a bunch of, I guess, smaller kind of independent movies. He's been in some bigger movies. But he's an actor that's worked continuously the last 30 years. So this is a very, very twisted movie, and it's really based off of two serial killers. One is it's Henry, who is the Michael Rooker character, Henry Lee Lucas, and the other one is Otis. And these are – it's loosely based on them. If you're familiar with the horrific crime that occurred, and I believe it was 1982, in and around the Hollywood, Florida area with Adam Walsh, which, Jeff, I know that you would be, and his father you know, is the guy that did that America's Most Wanted for years. But Adam Walsh was a kid who was abducted. He was found, I believe he was beheaded, and he was just a small child. And these were the two guys that, you know, it basically were responsible. I don't think they were ever convicted. They were dead at that point, whatever it was. But it, based off of all the research, these were the two guys most responsible. So this movie is a super creepy movie because it's really following, and it's kind of this documentary look, though it's a fake documentary, of two serial killers, and it's really super creepy. There's two scenes to me that are just mind-blowing. The first one is not as bad as the one I'm going to get to, but it's a scene towards the end where Henry has stepped out. There's a woman, there's really three characters in the movie, and it's Henry and Otis, and then there's Becky. And Becky's kind of in love with Henry, if that's the right word, has the hots for him, but she comes on to him. He kind of gets freaked out, and he leaves. And then Becky's alone with Otis, and Otis is drunk, and he tries to rape Becky. And as it turns off, Henry comes back and saves Becky. They fight. You know, there's all kinds of, like, broken bottles over the faces and the heads and all that. And eventually Becky stabs Otis in the eye with the handle of a metal comb. And then Henry stabs Otis, and he bleeds out, and then they start to dismember the body in a bathtub, and it's really graphic to the point that you're almost uncomfortable. The other scene, which is really the most
disturbing, you're saying movie, you're just almost uncomfortable watching the
dismember. Well, yeah, I haven't quite gotten the full uncomfortable, but the truth is, there's a scene that occurs earlier that you're numb at this point, and it's a scene, and it really is an incredible scene, and it's a scene where Henry and Otis go into a house. There's a family, children, and there's parents, and they go in and they torture and kill everybody in the house, and they film it, and it's all on videotape, and later they go back to their home, their trailer, wherever they're living, and they put the tape in the VCR, and they relive the experience and just kind of enjoy watching it. And it's really upsetting when you see it, and it's really a testament to the movie. Because I remember reading a review, and it was correlating it to a lot of the Eli Roth stuff that you and I have discussed, which is called torture porn. And this is really kind of the forerunner of torture porn. And it really, it's something that it's not for everybody, but this will scare the shit out of you. I mean, this is a movie, and I should clearly state, this movie was made, you're not going to believe this, Jeff, when I tell you, this movie was made for $110,000.
Wow.
And I don't, exactly, and you actually, the story, here, there's actually a wrestling connection. The guys that made this were were two brothers, the Ali brothers, and I believe they're based out of Chicago, and they had hired the director of this movie is a guy named John McNaughton, and he was like their delivery man for their video equipment rental business. They were supposed to direct a movie based off of the history of Chicago wrestling in the 1950s. And there was somebody in Chicago that had a collection of all this vintage wrestling of the 50s, and the guy was going to sell it to them so these brothers could make a documentary. Well, at the last minute, the owner doubled his price. The brothers said, fuck you, and they pulled out of the deal, and they had $100,000, and they were like, all right, we need to make a movie. Well, they got this guy, McNaughton, who was their delivery driver. He directed this movie, and they were able to get Michael Rooker, who I think was just coming up, $110,000. The beauty of this movie is, for $110,000, I'm not sure that there's a scarier movie out there that might have cost $50 million. So yeah, I recommend this movie. It is, I remember seeing it and being very disturbed by it. And I watched it again a couple of weeks back when you and I were kind of formulating this list. And I got to tell you, this is disturbing.
Yeah, Michael Rooker, I want to say that if he wasn't nominated for an Academy Award for this performance. I remember at the very least when the nominees were starting to get, you know, who was going to get nominated, and there's 10 people for the list of five. Michael Rooker's name was definitely out there because this was a really troubling performance. But yeah, to be honest with you, this is not the kind of role, as good as he is in this, that's going to get mentioned by the Academy Awards. They're not really huge fans of these kind of movies. There's another movie I'm going to discuss that quite shockingly was nominated for a Best Picture. Yeah, he's amazing. He's great in The Walking Dead, or when he was in The Walking Dead, and a guy that if you go through his IMDb page and you're like, oh yeah, he was in that too. Oh wow. Yeah. He's been in a zillion different things. He's always consistently does a great job and a really good actor.
Yeah. You brought him up a couple of weeks back and he was in something during one of our lists and I forget what it was, but you actually brought up his name. But yeah, it is amazing too. And so I was reading, you know, I did a little bit of research on the movie as well. And apparently he was so taken with this character that for the month it took to film this movie, he stayed completely in character.
Wow.
That, yeah, he wouldn't associate with anybody. He wouldn't associate with the rest of the crew. He stayed by himself and he stayed in character. That said, if you watch this movie, it really, truly paid off.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to my number four. My number four movie. You know, recently on the Breaking Kayfabe Facebook page, we had this guy that we had talked about, John Doe. Well, here in my number four movie, John Doe is one of the characters. And no, not as someone else mentioned, not the John Doe from the punk band X, by the way. John Doe is one of the characters in David Fincher's movie Seven with Brad Pitt. Morgan Freeman, I almost said Morgan Fairchild, Morgan Freeman, and Kevin Spacey plays John Doe. And wow, there are so many troubling scenes in this movie, so many chilling, creepy scenes. But the two that I'll point out, first of all, is the go-home scene. Gee, I really hope I'm not spoiling this movie that came out, 23 years ago. What's in the box? The end game scene of the movie, when Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman have got John Doe, they're going out to a remote site where he has something that he says he has for him. And yeah, just an amazing, creepy scene when what is in the box is revealed, Barry.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, the star of this movie is the director, David Fincher. This movie is creepy from the first scene to the last scene. It is 2 hours of creepiness, and that all comes from a truly great director. So it is. Kevin Spacey, you know, granted, that's a career that is completely done at this point. But, you know, unfortunately, and we can always discuss, you know, is a great artist still a great artist, even if they've been excommunicated to some degree? You and I have talked about that previously. But he does a fantastic job. Kevin Spacey's great. Morgan Freeman. Morgan Fairchild would have been great in this movie, by the way.
Great point.
She would have been tremendous in this movie. But I like Seven. And Seven was a movie, when I first saw it, that I didn't like. And I don't know, I didn't connect with it in the theater. I don't know what happened. Maybe I was I think my expectation was probably something different. And I watched it on cable a couple of years after it came out, and it was midnight, and wife was asleep, and I'm just sitting there watching it, and lo and behold, 2 hours later, I'm like, this is a pretty damn good movie. So, yeah, I enjoy Seven a lot. And, yeah, that scene, yeah, what's in the box, man?
Yeah, and the other scene I want to talk about from this movie that will creep you out to no end, if you have never seen the movie, is the detectives go with a squad of police to where they think the suspect is residing. And they go into the apartment, and on the wall is written the word sloth, or as Morgan Freeman says, sloth. And there is a man in the bed that appears to have been killed in a horrific, horrific, torturous manner. And they're investigating this completely horrific body. And then all of a sudden, the body coughs and they realize that the person is still alive. And if that doesn't skeeve you out when you see that scene, then I don't know. You apparently don't have that chromosome. Barry, tell me about what you thought of that scene.
Yeah. You have to be skeeved out. And if you don't, then I don't want to know you because there's something really, really frightening about you. But yeah, you're 100% right. Again, this is a movie. The real star is the director because he's really crafted something here. It's almost like like you're walking through a haunted house for 2 hours, because every scene is creepy. There's a tone to it, and it's a tone that it doesn't always happen in movies. You know, there's, you and I were talking about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I didn't put it on my list because it's a horror movie. But really, the star of that movie was the director, Tobe Hooper, because from beginning to end, it's a super creepy movie. And it's the way it was directed. So, yeah, I would agree with you on this one.
Absolutely. Now tell me your number three.
My number three is a movie that came out last year, the year before, called A Cure for Wellness, directed by Gore Verbinski, not really starring anybody really famous either. And did you happen to see this movie, by the way?
No, I know the one you're talking about because I saw the trailer for it. And this is the one where there's the I don't want to say the laboratory, but where they have the people there and like some sort of animation or something like that.
It's really, and it's going to be really difficult for me to give you a synopsis and tell you what this movie's about, but this movie essentially was a bomb. I think it made about a third of whatever it actually cost to film. I will say this is probably my favorite movie of the last 5 or 10 years that I've seen. It's been on cable the last couple of months, and every time it's on, it's reached that Roadhouse. Patrick Swayze, by the way, I get to say his name this week.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, it's reached the Roadhouse, Fletch, National Lampoon's Vacation stage for me that I can turn it on, and regardless of where the movie is, I will just sit and watch it. And essentially, it's about a young guy that goes over to, I think it's the Swiss Alps, to get somebody that is at this spa there to bring him back to America. And one thing leads to another, and he gets trapped in the spa. Anyways, there's a couple of creepy scenes. One is kind of a direct ripoff of what you were just talking about with Marathon Man. They get this young man named Lockhart. They strap him into a chair, and they drill into his teeth. And it does not break away. Unlike the Marathon Man, this shows you 100%. As it drills in the teeth, you see the tooth as they're drilling, you know, pieces of the tooth are going flying, and then blood drips out, and you can hear his blood-curdling screams. That's enough to make you grip onto your chair. But there's another scene where they tie him down, and they crank open his mouth, and I don't know what type of a tool it is. It's like a speculum for the mouth, I guess. And they force a tube down his throat into his stomach, and they pump water with eels into his stomach.
Oh, my.
And yeah, exactly. And when you watch this, you just sit there and go, oh, my God, how do they film this and how do they do this? And it's a long story about the eels and the water, and that's really what the whole movie is about. It's a fantastic movie, and it's really funny because I see a lot of movies. I saw It, you know, over the last couple of years, It, which is a great movie. I saw Get Out, which is a good movie. And then my favorite movie is this movie that was considered a bomb because it's highly unique and it's really, really beautiful, though. There's this theme song that goes throughout the movie, so it's super creepy. Again, this is another one that goes start to finish with the creepiness. There are certain scenes that just hit a home run, but at the same time, this is very similar to Seven in that from the second you start watching it, you know you're watching something. So I love A Cure for Wellness. It's highly recommended, Jeff. I think you definitely should check it out. I think you would like it. I'd be curious to know what you think.
Okay, so my number three, as I was going and preparing this list, I actually did the old Google search, you know, creepy scenes from movies. And as I was sitting there doing the Google search, this particular movie that I'd seen popped up, and I kind of did the holy shit, I can't believe I forgot about this movie, because it'd been a while since I've seen this movie. And this movie is actually a movie from the Netherlands. It came out in 1988. It is the original, not the crappy American remake from about 15 years ago with Jeff Bridges and Kiefer Sutherland. This is the original version of the movie The Vanishing, which was called in Dutch Spoorloos. And folks, I got to tell you something. Most of the movies that I'm talking about here, I'm not sure what the remainder of Barry's list is, are movies that have pretty much been out there. They're kind of mainstream movies that people may or, you know, have probably seen by this point if they have any interest in seeing it. This is a movie that if you have not seen it, if you're into creepy horror films or thriller movies, go see this movie now because it is amazing. It is, Barry, have you ever seen this movie?
Yeah, I have seen this movie, and I absolutely – so I actually like the American version as well. It does not hold a candle to this movie whatsoever, though. This is at a completely different level, yes.
Okay, so here's sort of the quick story synopsis. A young couple are driving throughout Europe, and they stop off at a gas station rest area. The guy's pumping gas into his car. They've been together for a long time. She wants to get married. He's not really committing. To a long-term nature of relationship. She goes in, so they're having this conversation. She goes in to, get a soda, go to the bathroom, something like that. The guy's pumping gas. Traffic is coming in and out of the rest area, and the girl disappears without a trace. And nobody knows what happened to her. This was obviously before cameras were everywhere in our lives. And so the guy literally spends 3 years of his life in a desperate, obsessive quest to try to find out what happened to this woman that had been such a major part of his life. And then what happens, without spoiling the movie, because I realize this isn't as out there as some of the other movies we've talked about, is he's approached by somebody who says that he has the answer to this question of what happened to this woman. But he has certain conditions that have to be met before he will let this guy know what happened to his girlfriend. And folks, I can't even begin to tell you, the ending of this movie is as shocking and horrific as you'll ever see. And one of the things that makes this movie so great is because in this movie, the bad guy is not, Jason. He's not Freddy Krueger. He's not somebody that's, very obviously, this isn't Jack the Ripper. This is a perfectly normal guy that could be your neighbor. And then you find out that he has made a decision just to see what he can get away with. And what he does is so creepy and so evil. And the fact that he's so seemingly normal makes it all the more scary. And I will say, Barry said that he liked the American version. To me, the American version just can't even hold a candle to this original movie called The Vanishing. Its director was a guy named George Sluzer, and it's absolutely fantastic, and you need to go out of your way to find this movie because it is really a work of art, and it's a very rare horror work of art, horror thriller work of art, but an amazing, amazing film.
Yeah, and I should say, too, so the woman who plays Saskia, if I'm pronouncing it correctly,
yes.
And I forget. Yeah, I got to admit, I had a crush on her when this movie came out because I remember seeing this in 1988 going, man, she's adorable. So I Googled her when we were going through our list of movies, and now she's a woman. Obviously, it's 30 years later. She's still smoking hot. She's still, really? In my opinion, super hot. This movie, though, I think the issue that we're running into right now is that if we ever do our top five favorite foreign films, we now have to remove this because we've already discussed it. This would have been one of my top five favorite foreign films of all time. This is, and I clearly, let me really say, this movie is head and shoulders above the American version. I do like the American version, but this is not. This is at a different level from the acting to the directing. And I'm a huge Jeff Bridges fan, obviously. But this is just a fantastic movie. And it's sad. When the movie's over, it's not like you're going to go out skipping and dancing either. You're going to be bummed out. It's a downer, but as a work of art, and that's what you said, and that's the comparison to A Cure for Wellness as well. This is not your typical horror movie. This is a work of art. This is a beautiful movie on many, many different levels too.
Yeah. Strongest recommendation from, the gentleman here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Barry, give me your number two film.
Wait a minute. There's gentlemen here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin.
I probably have overstepped myself there.
All right. So for me, my number one and my number two are two of my favorite movies. And it's if you like the song Inagata De Vida, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Michael Mann's Manhunter, 1986 Manhunter, starring William Peterson. We touched on this briefly when we were talking about car chases, because I brought up a car chase from To Live and Die in L.A. And before he went to CSI, the William Peterson, who plays Will Graham in this movie, was just fantastic. So this movie essentially is the precursor to Silence of the Lambs. And there's an appearance in here by Hannibal Lecter. He's played by Brian Cox. Anthony Hopkins has not taken over the role yet, but essentially, really at the end of the movie, Francis Dalahide, who I think a lot of people are going to know from Red Dragon when he was played by Ralph Fiennes some 10 years later. And essentially Red Dragon is almost a remake shot for shot of Manhunter. But Francis Dalahide, who is played by Tom Noonan, who is this guy that's about 6'5", 6'6", bald, super creepy. He's got this woman in his house, and she's a blind woman named Reba, played by the great actress Joan Allen. And he's playing this song by Iron Butterfly, Inagata Davida, as he's going to kill her with a knife. And he's mentally torturing her because she is blind. And it's just dun, 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 and it continues, and it's super creepy. He's playing photos and video footage on the wall of his house of families he's killed previously. So it's all these. And then you take Michael Mann, who is, you and I have talked about Michael Mann as we did with the movie Heat when we did the Robert De Niro episode, but Michael Mann visually, I mean, this guy, you know, there was always a knock on Michael Mann that he was more visual and less substance. And I disagree with that because this is just visually, this is a stupendous movie, and it's just beautiful in its artistic flair. At the same time, there's a lot of substance to it. So the ending scene, and again, if I'm fucking this up for anybody and blowing a spoiler 32 years later, really sorry, but it's 32 years later at this point. The ending scene as this song is playing has got this slow motion shot of William Peterson breaking through the glass to get in the house to get to Dalahide. And it's, you know, this is the difference between a hack director and a real film director, because Michael Mann has created something with this. So Manhunter is one of my favorite movies of all time. I've got it on my DVR, and it still plays on cable. And it's another one that, you know, I've said it a couple of times this episode. If it's on, I stop what I'm doing. I watch it. I don't care where it's at. A tremendous movie. I can't say enough good about this movie. And I know you've seen it.
Yeah, no, this is a tremendous movie. And, you know, it's funny, you were talking about the use of music in that pivotal scene. And as I was sitting here listening to that, I thought the way that music plays such a role in my two favorite movies in this category that I'll bring up. But no, this is tremendous. Brian Cox, the original Hannibal Lecter, is, and this performance is really forgotten. He is so good in this movie.
Yeah.
When I first heard Anthony Hopkins was taking over the role, I was like, oh my God, why didn't they get Brian Cox? And as good as Anthony Hopkins was in his performance of Hannibal Lecter, Brian Cox is almost nearly his equal. And think about that, because that movie, or that role, just became so iconic for Anthony Hopkins, and that Brian Cox almost matches him. And there's a scene where he's in jail. And of course, he has limited access to anything because he's the, you know, horrible Hannibal Lecter. And he gets a phone, and the way he manipulates somebody on the phone to give him information by saying that he doesn't have the use of his hands, it's just absolutely amazing. And I know, yeah, William Peterson's great. Joan Allen, what a great underrated actress that she is. A lot of people know Joan Allen from the Bourne Identity series and the Bourne Ultimatum. She played like the head of the CIA, and she's a really, really strong actress. And one of those actresses that pretty much every role that she plays, she's absolutely 100% solid.
Yeah, no, you know, you're spot on the money too. So there'll always be that debate about Anthony Hopkins versus Brian Cox. And I got to admit, I think I lean more towards Brian Cox, because as great as Anthony Hopkins was, and he was, look, he was fantastic in Silence of the Lambs, is one of the greatest movies ever. But at the same time, there's this kind of understated delivery from Brian Cox. He's not over the top, and it's menacing. His understated delivery is really menacing. And I understand why you would put Anthony Hopkins in the role, because, A, this was a bigger film, and you needed to sell tickets. And in 1990 or 91, whenever that movie came out, Anthony Hopkins was an absolutely huge name, and Brian Cox wasn't. And I think that's partly the reason for the change. That being said, you know, I could watch that scene that you just, as you just described, where he doesn't have use of his hands, and how easy it was for him to get that information. I remember sitting there going, holy shit, that this is genius. So I love this movie. I absolutely just love it.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And what's ironic is that my number two creepiest movie is Silence of the Lambs. What are the odds, Barry? Silent Slams came out in 1991. It won the 1992 Best Picture Oscar. It's an amazing, amazing film. So chilling and scary. But here's the great thing is the two scenes that I'm going to bring up do not involve Sir Anthony Hopkins. They involve Ted Levine, who is, oh my God, he's such a great character actor. Ted Levine, by the way, since I brought this up before, is a guy that is also in the TV show The Alienist that I brought up. He plays a character in that show, which is just getting ready to wrap up a season run. But the two particular scenes that I want to discuss from Silence of the Lamb that really creeped me out were the first scene when the young girl that has been kidnapped by Jamie Gumm is down in her well, a hole that he's dug in his basement, and she's screaming for help. And at the moment this is happening, you hear or you see Jamie Gumm beginning to metamorphosize into the character, you know, to what he believes he should become. He's killed these women. He's skinning these women. And he's taking their skin and he's making himself a dress made out of human skin. How creepy is that, Barry? And while he's doing that, the song that is playing is a song called Goodbye Horses by an artist named Q Lazarus, who I got to be honest with you, I've never heard before. But the song fits so well into the scene as what he's doing is he's putting on, he puts a nipple ring on and then he's putting lipstick on. And he does the, dare I say, Barry, the old tuck in there. And he looks at himself as if he was a woman. And he says famously, would you fuck me? I'd fuck me. And it, the skeeve out factor is very high at this point, Barry.
No, it is. So to that end, the true star of this movie is Ted Levine. It's all, here's the other part. When you look at it, Buffalo Bill has become an iconic figure. You know, here's a movie that's almost 30 years old at this point, and he based off of it. He was in a bunch of TV shows. He was in Monk with for years, the television show Monk. He played either detective or the captain of the police force. I forget exactly what his role was, but he's become iconic based off of this role, and he was the reason. And you know, everything about this movie, the whole area in which he keeps the girls in the pits and this whole dungeon and the darkness, you know, the way this thing was filmed and it's all murky and it's just super creepy. So I'm going to tie this into last week's episode, Jeff. And I think I mentioned this last week when I saw Silence of the Lambs. I had dinner at Char Hut, the one that was on 441. I clearly remember that night going to see Silence of the Lambs and having dinner at Char Hut. I love this movie, though. This is one of those, and you and I, we generally share our lists of movies that we're going to do, and then I'm like, well, wait a minute, can I get that one? We'll even trade. And had you not chosen Silence of the Lambs, I would have taken it and put it on my list. It definitely deserves to be here.
Yeah, and then the other scene that I was going to talk about that's extremely troubling in this is a scene that follows not too far afterwards where Jodie Foster – as Agent Clarice comes to talk to Jamie Gumm, not even realizing she's just doing some house-to-house research, not even realizing that she's knocked on the door of the guy that is Buffalo Bill. And she ends up realizing who it is. She goes into his house, and he goes on the run. She finds the girl in the hole, and then there's a scene where she goes into a room searching him. She's searching room to room, and the lights go out. And he puts on the night goggles, and you're seeing it from his point of view as Jodie Foster, as Clarice Starling is kind of feeling her way around the room while he's watching her through the night scope. And wow, is that a super creepy scene, because he could kill her at any moment. But in his psychosis as the serial killer, Buffalo Bill, Jamie Gumm, he's watching her just because he feels like he's controlling her at that moment and he can do anything he wants with her.
Yeah, and he can, and he absolutely can.
Very troubling. Okay, Barry, it's that time. Give us your number one all-time creepiest movie.
Yeah, definitely. And so, in my opinion, too, this is maybe the creepiest scene of any non-horror movie ever filmed. It is one that you had on your list, and as I just mentioned with the aforementioned trade, I was like, Jeff, you got to give me that one, because that is one that I'll watch all the time. It is from the movie 1986, directed by David Lynch, Blue Velvet, starring Dennis Hopper. And this is the film that kind of brought Dennis Hopper back into Hollywood. He had kind of either been making B movies or just, you know, non-existent movies for years, and this kind of rejuvenated his career. But the whole movie, so this also goes into the 7 Cure for Wellness, this whole movie is fucking creepy. I mean, start to finish, this is one big creep fest. But there's a scene in here that is the creepiest scene, at least in my opinion, of any movie ever out there. And it's the scene where Dennis Hopper is basically going back and forth between dominating Isabella Rossellini and then being her baby. And all the while, he's sucking the oxygen mask. And I don't know what, I guess it excites him and he gets insane. So he'll go from this 1 minute of incredible rage where he's screaming and you fucking whore and he's calling her all these names. And the next minute is you love baby. And he's breathing and he's sucking and he's going. And all the while, Kyle MacLachlan is watching from the closet through a slat in the wind in the closet. So he's watching this scene, and Isabella Rossellini is completely, she can do nothing because Frank Booth, who's played by Dennis Hopper, has kidnapped her child. So, and you know, and partly as this movie progresses, she enjoys this to some degree. You know, this is something that she actually looks forward to. So, you know, it just frightening to me. And this is one of those movies, too, that I watched it when it first came out. And I like shit that's really offbeat. And I like the David Lynch films. And I was always a big Kyle MacLachlan fan. And I think partly, you know, he made this great movie with Michael Norrie years ago, that what the fuck was the name of this movie about aliens? And I just thought this was just such a cool movie. So this is a movie I saw, and I thought it was good when I saw it in the theaters, but I didn't, you know, I kind of moved on from it. And then I caught it on cable 5-10 years later, and I just remember sitting there going, holy cow, what is this? This is the sickest thing I have ever seen. Dennis Hopper deserves an Academy Award, or deserved, I should say deserved. He's dead, and this movie's 32 years old. He deserves some sort of recognition, and maybe he got it. Not from the Academy, but maybe a Golden Globe or something. This is not an acting job that you see every day. This is at a different level, and this is the creepiest scene. I was watching this movie with my son a few months ago, and normally I'd never feel uncomfortable when my son, who was 17 years old, and I felt really uncomfortable watching this scene with him. So I know you've seen it. What do you think about this movie?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. What a troubling movie this is that, and Dennis Hopper's performance, I think you're spot on when you say this kicked him back into the Hollywood mainstream, because it was such an effective. Kyle MacLachlan, you mentioned, who's famous to many people as the star of Twin Peaks, the TV show.
Yeah.
But this, this is it's just troubling is the best way. That the scene where he's, you know, in the closet and he's watching this weirdness go on in the beginning of the movie, when he's just walking through a field one day and finds an ear laying on the ground, just a random person's ear. But that's like a really super, super creepy moment in the movie and super creepy film.
And it's not a short scene either. I mean, it's literally 4 or 5 minutes long that he's watching this. And that movie I was just trying to think about with Michael Norrie was called The Hidden. And it's a very small movie. Came out right after Blue Velvet. I highly recommend that one as well. But Blue Velvet, if you've never seen it, it's definitely not for everybody. But if you like the offbeat shit, this is about the definition of offbeat. And you're absolutely right about the year. We should have known when he found the year, right from the get-go, what was going to happen with this movie.
Yeah. Now, I believe I've seen The Hidden, too. That was a really strong film. I really liked it.
Yep.
So now it's time for my number one film, my number one all-time creep-out movie. Barry, I'm just going to say this. If you've ever seen David Fincher's Zodiac and watched the scene where Donovan Song Hurdy-Gurdy Man plays, and you can never – I can never listen to that song when it comes on the radio and not think of – David Fincher's movie Zodiac that came out in 2007 with Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Edwards. It's about a group of people who are searching for the Zodiac Killer in San Francisco in the late 60s, early 70s, into the late 70s. And it's about the obsessive search of Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Robert Graysmith, who was a cartoonist for the San Francisco Chronicle. And it ended up costing him his marriage because he just obsessively searched for this person. But the scene in the movie that troubles me, two scenes. There is a young couple that's sitting out having a picnic makeout session by a lake. They're completely by themselves. And the woman looks up and she says, there's someone coming. I guess there's somebody else out here. And as the guy becomes, she goes, he's wearing a mask. I think he may have a gun. He's going to rob us. And the person comes and ties up the couple and, you know, but instead of robbing them, as the people have their arms cuffed or tied behind their back, he begins stabbing the man as the woman is sitting there watching her boyfriend getting stabbed. And it is so just unbelievably troubling to see that and listen to the woman's screams. And there's one other scene I want to talk about in particular, but Barry, I know you remember that scene.
Yeah, I do too. And it really is troubling. And I'll tell you the other part is that scene has been copied. You know, I watched the television show American Horror Story, and they basically copied that scene shot for shot. And a lot of other movies have utilized that as well. But that was really, really frightening. And I remember, you know, we watch it, we know it's a movie, and at the same time, we feel this empathy for the two people about to be killed.
Yeah. And now the number one scene in this movie that to me is disturbing, chilling, creepy, whatever you want to say, is a scene where a young woman is driving in her car, and she has her infant child in the front seat. Excuse me. And car behind her starts honking at her, and she pulls over, and the guy says, I noticed there's something wrong with one of your tires. You know, let me take a look at it for you. So the woman is there. She's out in this lonely stretch of highway, and the guy ends up basically offering to give her a ride back to town so she can get a mechanic to come out and fix her car. She gets in the car with this man with her baby, and as they're driving along, suddenly she realizes something is very, very wrong. And the guy says to her, I want to tell you what I'm going to do after I kill you. I'm going to take your child, your baby, your infant, and I'm going to throw her out the window of the car. And then I'm going to drive away. And the woman is in complete and utter terror and utter panic. And I, you know, Barry, now that I'm sitting here recalling this, I can't remember if he lets her out of the car or if she jumps out of the car. But when the police eventually come, the woman is off on the side of the road, basically in a fetal position, you know, screaming because this man has terrified her so much. And I remember when I being a quality parent, I took my kids to see this movie back in the time. And I remember sitting in the theater going, holy shit, that is just, oh my God, you know, just the mental picture that is, you know, that comes to mind when the guy says her, and he's just so matter of fact when he says it. And, you know, spoiler alert for a 10 or 11 year old movie, they don't solve the crime. The Zodiac is one of the most famous cases in American, you know, criminal history that has never been solved. They have some ideas who they think that it was, but they never actually solved it. So Barry, tell me what you think about this.
Yeah. Well, I think I know two guys who should try and solve this, which is you and I, Jeff.
Maybe,
should try to solve this one.
Maybe in an upcoming episode.
That's an idea right there.
Spoiler alert.
I think this is Fincher's best film. And when you consider that, you know, again, he did Seven, he did Fight Club, which is, you know, I think it's probably his most popular film. He did Gone Girl. He did The Social Network. But this movie is such a great movie. You got some strong actors in this movie, too. But again, Fincher is a great director. I think he's an underrated director too, because he's, you know, even though he's had these blockbusters, and Gone Girl certainly is a great movie. That's a creepy movie too, actually. You know, you just never hear about him in that upper echelon of your Spielbergs and whoever else is big. I don't even know, but you just never hear his name mentioned. But I think he's great in this movie. This movie is, because there's not an ending to this movie, I think it works. I love it. I'm trying to find in my head what I feel is great. I think I think this was Downey Jr.'s best movie also. And when I say that, it's not his biggest movie, obviously, but as an actor, Robert Downey Jr. can be all over the place, at least in my opinion, can be all over the place. But I think he did a great job, and his pairing with Gyllenhaal, too, really does work. This movie works on so many different levels. I don't know. You know, I want to sit here and I want to tell you I love this movie, but should every movie we've brought up this week, I'm sitting here going, this is tremendous, and I love it. So I don't want to be that guy, even though I am that guy. But this is a fantastic movie. So I am that guy, see?
Yeah, just to throw out a couple other movies. he did Michael Douglas's movie The Game, which was a really,
another
really
great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which was an amazing film. Not quite as good as the original European version, but still a very, very good movie. David Fincher, just a real quality director. One of those guys that's, you know, you look at this guy and, you know, you're pretty much assured you're going to get a great movie out of him.
Yeah, he's never, and that's a great point you just brought up by even bringing up those movies. He's never made a shitty film. I don't think there's a shitty film there.
No, not at all. So,
wow.
All right, before we go, we're going to wrap it up. We're going to give a couple of quick mentions. As we discussed last week, I can now announce that next week we are doing top five nude scenes. Ooh, Barry, this is going to be a PG-13 episode of Breaking Kayfabe.
It is, too. So I want to apologize to your father in advance for next week's episode.
Dad, maybe take this week off. That's all I'm going to say.
We're going dark next week, Mr. Bowdrin, so maybe take that one off.
But this week wasn't dark enough, Barry.
Yeah, but this is going to be a lot of fun. So we're not, and we have to clarify this too. We're not talking about, this is not Linda Lovelace in Deep Throat. We are looking at mainstream movies, movies that, you know, you could go into a theater and not have to wear a raincoat to see, and that feature nudity in some form. And we're going to, you know, movies that are iconic, whether it's something you remember from, you know, your youth or something you saw last week. But if it's a nude scene in a movie and it made an impression on us, you'll be hearing about it next week.
Absolutely. And then Barry and I can now reveal, Barry hinted at it, in 2 weeks, it will be episode 26. We will have gotten Barry half a year of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Where did the time go? But in episode 26, we are going to be discussing our favorite unsolved mysteries. We're going to be each taking a look. I don't know if we're going to do five. We may not have time to do five, Barry. We might just have to stick to three. But we're going to devote an entire special edition of Breaking Kayfabe to unsolved mysteries that we think need to be discussed, need to be talked about. Barry, what do you think about that episode? You looking forward to that?
Yeah, so I actually am. And it's so, and let's be honest on this one, Jeff. You said this to me 4 or 5 months ago. So this has been something that you've been really excited about. This is going to be something that I think is going to be a little different than what we normally do, because it's probably not going to be as humorous or as lighthearted. But at the same time, I think it's going to be a little revolutionary in some form, because you and I have been doing a lot of research on some of these cases. So I think we're going to present some stuff that people may never have heard before, or, you know, I don't know. This is going to be really, really interesting.
Absolutely. So finally, before we go, I mentioned Chris Spiker, fan of the show, had asked me about my top five TRU stories, which extremely troubled Barry Rose, certain aspects of my past that he didn't know about. He also asked me, because we, of course, at the intro to each show and the exit, we play the song Spirit of Radio by Rush. He asked me to give him his top five Rush songs, or give me my top five Rush songs. Chris, I can't let you have everything you want. I'm going to give you a top three. Top three Rush songs for me. I'm going number three, Limelight. Number two, Spirit of Radio. My number one all-time favorite Rush song, Tom Sawyer. Every time I hear Tom Sawyer, I sit there in my mind and I see Kerry Von Erich going down the steps of the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas, on his way to the ring. That's my favorite Rush song of all time. Perry, you got a quick favorite top three Rush songs?
Yeah, so I can give you, so Tom Sawyer's in there as well. YYZ is in there, and I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce this, La Villa Strangiata, which is, and these are, you know, the last two aren't their two biggest songs, but I love Rush. Fantastic. Never saw them live, and I'm bummed.
Say hello to Ozzy in the background there, by the way.
Do you hear Ozzy?
Yeah, I heard Ozzy.
He's freaking out. All right,
folks, on behalf of Barry Rose, this is Jeff Bowdrin. Follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, soon to feature an upgraded and bigger server for your listening pleasure. Till next time, folks, have a good one.